I'm Faith Middleton. Thank you so much for listening. This is a story about a little girl named Chelsea Wheeler who lives in rural Oxford, Connecticut, the kind of small town that used to have a post office, barbershop in one room. It's also the kind of town where citizens contributed a town hall to a giving tree set up in the Wheeler family name. I'm not sure how many 11-year-old children fantasize about what they want to be. Chelsea Wheeler knows exactly what she wants to be, a chef who runs a diner. That her body has rebelled, that she has spent so many years unable to ingest or taste any real food is no deterrent. Chelsea receives liquid nutrients pumped into her body through an intravenous line attached to a backpack she wears all the time. It's been many years since she tasted real food. Instead, Chelsea concentrates as much of her energy as possible on her purpose and her plan. She watches the Food Network constantly, and she waits. She is among 262 patients in the United States who need a small bowel transplant. Someone must die for Chelsea and the others to qualify for this expensive operation. If it works out for her, Chelsea will remain in the hospital for a year. Already, she's had 30 different surgeries. She's been sick almost all her life. But maybe this child understands the difference between curing and healing, if healing is about adjusting to the circumstances in front of you. While I haven't met her, I know this about Chelsea because I was sitting around swapping stories, as reporters like to do, with Doug Clement of Connecticut Magazine. That's when he told me all about Chelsea Wheeler and how much he admired her and her family. They're all here. As a longtime food reporter, I couldn't pass up the chance to meet another food lover, one with a dream and a plan. Chelsea Wheeler, Mrs. Wheeler, Doug Clement, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thanks, Faith.
Thank you.
Chelsea, I have been dying to meet you. I am so glad you're here. And as you know, those sneakers are the most awesome sneakers I have ever seen. They're, what would you say? I don't know. It's like, are they, is that like leopard except pink and black and white? I'm crazy about sneakers. Those are the best I've ever seen.
Thank you.
I know. And you're gonna tell me after the show where I can get those, right? Do you think I could wear them and not look stupid?
They go up to different, like, bigger sizes, like 7, 8.
Okay, great.
You could get them.
Okay, good. But how will I look is the question.
I don't know. Have you ever tried pink leopard print?
No, but I really think I should. Because I think I could wear those to a dressy thing. You know, if I had a dress on, I had to go to something fancy. That pink leopard thing, I think, would really work. Do you?
These work with everything.
Okay, see? I knew. You're my style person. Okay, so now, what kind of food do you plan to serve at your restaurant when you're old enough to do it?
Seafood, hot dogs, hamburgers, Italian food, a little bit of everything.
So from all kinds of cultures,
yes.
You mean? Okay, so Italian. Would there be any other cultures, like Greek or?
Well, Italian, French, yeah.
And does the restaurant in your mind have a name yet?
Chelsea's.
And where do you think it would be located? Is it in this part of the country?
Well, I have a place in Woodbury picked out. It's a big wood place, and I am in love with it.
Now, well, how did you find it?
Well, my sister goes to Nanawak High School, and so when we were driving, I found it.
You just saw it on the road and said, that's my place?
Pretty much.
Wow. And can you describe it a little bit?
It's big, and it's dark wood, and there's lots of windows in the front, and it's awesome.
Wow. And is there, now, you need parking.
There's parking.
Is there enough?
Probably.
Okay. You have to check that out because that's really, it's a big issue, I think. Well, let's pretend that Chelsea's is open and I walk in the door for the first time. What is the atmosphere? What does this place look like inside? Have you thought that through?
There's going to be bright color walls. One side's going to be with like arcade games. The other side's going to, then there's another one for like, there's a bar and TVs. And then there's just kind of like there's a place with booths, so a family could just sit in one and and then there's tiles and old-fashioned, like, poodle skirt waders. Yeah, I got it planned out on roller skates.
Wow.
It's going to be a fun place to hang out.
Wow, and dessert.
Everything covered in chocolate.
So it is wall-to-wall chocolate after the meal.
Everybody likes chocolate.
Yeah, so you're thinking about popularity, you know, getting people to come in the door.
Yes.
This is good. Now, did you say there are multiple televisions?
Yeah, like with football games, so like dads can go and watch football, eat nachos, that kind of stuff, drink a beer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and there are TVs on for other people too, other channels.
Yes, like family-friendly channels.
So how do you watch the Cooking Network pretty often? And what shows do you watch?
I watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, Chopped, Cupcake Wars.
And do you feel like you're picking up technique? Are you learning from them?
Yes.
Or is it mostly just fun to watch?
Both.
Yeah. The one thing that interests me is who is the chef? I know you're the owner of the restaurant, and you might have partners, because that's often how it goes. But who's the chef?
I will be the chef, but my dad will help out. And my little sister wants to be a waiter.
Okay, so she's on roller skates.
Yes.
Is your dad
training her already?
You are. And your dad is on roller skates?
Or? No. He can't do roller skates. He'd be helping me cook.
Okay, and your mom?
My mom will probably be sitting and being my taste tester.
And so you're going to be doing the cooking. And, you know, is this like a diner style?
Yes.
Okay. And you have a philosophy?
Well, it's going to be so high quality. You don't need to be a millionaire to eat there because it'll be, well, good priced. But you'll feel like one because it's good quality.
You know, I think this is a winning thing. And does it have tablecloths? That's another thing.
Well, I don't think the booths will, but maybe the other section.
The other section that are what we call...
Like a fancier section, maybe.
Oh, so it's going to go from relaxed to people who want...
There'll be different sections. So people, it depends on their mood. Because I know I can wake up one day and I could go feel really relaxed. And the other day, I want to go out a fancy dinner.
Okay. So I have this philosophy, Chelsea, where I think, because I know you haven't actually eaten real food for a long time. You know, I mean, years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So I have a philosophy that when I have dinner with my family or my friends, it's way more about other things than just chewing food, you know? And so how do you think about it? When you have dinner each night with your family and, you know, you're getting your nutrients through your backpack and the lines that are attached to you, that liquid feeding. So, but when you sit down to dinner with the family, how do you think about that time together?
It's about looking back at the day and sharing your experiences, looking forward to the week ahead, and really just relaxing with your family.
That's what I think a meal is. Yeah, it's the best part of the meal, I think.
But good food never hurts anyone.
And do you have any other, you know, dinner time chores?
Well, sometimes I help with the dishes. Sometimes I help clean up the table. I set the table sometimes. And that's it. Yeah.
Okay.
And I help serve sometimes.
Okay. So now, Chelsea, I want people to understand, you know, some of the medical issue. I think the most important thing is the food and your passion for this. So is it okay if I ask about some of the medical stuff?
Yes.
With your mother. Okay. Linda Wheeler, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, no, it's our pleasure. This is quite remarkable. So I don't know. I was asking Chelsea when this started with her interest in food. And so around what time period did you discover that Chelsea had these medical issues and have to switch over to feeding through the tube?
She's had medical issues since birth, and she's been back and forth between tube feedings and eating by mouth since birth. So she's never had a normal diet like the rest of us, you know, even when she was able to eat, there was a lot of restrictions on what she could eat. So I think as more food was taken away, her interest for cooking and helping and being part of it has increased, especially over the last 2 years. She's just wanted to be in the kitchen. She likes grocery shopping. She likes picking the list of foods and with recipes in mind for the week. And she's in the kitchen every night with me preparing dinner.
Chelsea, I didn't know that. So you're designing menus already.
Yes. I have me and my sister sometimes in summer vacation or on the weekends, we will go shopping with Mom and then make a menu for the night. And we will put up a sign and it'll be like our own restaurant for a night. And we'll have our own menu, like appetizers, main course, dessert. And we'll have drink options and then we'll just like play restaurant.
Wow. And so this is excellent training for later. I think this
and
is
then
excellent.
She goes on roller skates.
Your sister's already
yes.
training?
I am teaching her how to ride on roller skates. She has done it numerous times.
And are you on skates?
Well, no, I'm not coordinated enough to be on skates.
Oh,
I might hurt myself.
So only the staff is on skates, okay.
She knows her limitations.
Yeah, okay. So, Linda, can you explain, Chelsea, I don't even know the official name of what your medical issue is. And so,
Pseudo-obstruction.
Pseudo-obstruction. Okay, and Linda Wheeler, what does that mean?
It basically means that her body, her intestines, her stomach will act as though there's an obstruction, even though there is, by x-ray, there's not an actual obstruction, but her intestines, her stomach don't contract and don't move food along like the rest of us. So she goes through the periods where if she would eat, the food would just sit in her stomach and basically be obstructed because it couldn't move along. And after just one bout after another 2 years ago, in and out of the hospital, is when they sent us for more testing in Boston. They realized that she's an irreversible intestinal failure and, put her on the TPN, which is the feeding right into, her central vein, and which is how she's nourished now.
Okay, and so there are all kinds of nutrients in that liquid.
Yes, it's liquid gold.
Liquid gold, yeah. I'm so glad we have that.
Yes.
All right, so here's what we're going to do. Because I know, Chelsea, that you have had, I think, more than 30 surgeries already, which is amazing. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And I know that you're waiting for a transplant and that this is all a pretty expensive deal. So we're going to talk about that on the other side of this break, and I hope you will stay with us as we get to know Chelsea Wheeler and the Wheeler family and Doug Clement from Connecticut Magazine, who introduced me to these lovely people. But these are my kind of food people. So thanks for staying with us. We'll be right back. I'm laughing. I'm Faith Middleton. It is great to have you listening. We're meeting the Wheeler family from Oxford, Connecticut. A Chelsea Wheeler, Linda Wheeler, her mother is here. We have Doug Clement from Connecticut Magazine, who has introduced me to the Wheelers and has been a champion of this family, and understandably so. I wanted to meet Chelsea and Mrs. Wheeler, because Chelsea is a foodie of the first order and has been talking about her plans to open a restaurant, which would be called Chelly's, near Oxford. She's got the building picked out. She's got the plan going. It's absolutely fantastic. So just to catch you up, if you're just joining the show, one of the unusual things about this story is that Chelsea is 11 and has had many, many surgeries since she was born and has a disease that has made her small bowel fail. And so she is in line among 260 or so people. She's waiting for a bowel transplant. And it is an extraordinarily expensive operation. And so, Mrs. Wheeler, tell me about this. And Doug, would you join me in this part of the conversation? Because you've been researching this for a long time. By the way, if you would like to find out more about Chelsea or to volunteer in some way toward her cause, it is at our site right now, WNPR.org, and just search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Linda Wheeler, how many surgeries has Chelsea had?
Over 30, easily.
And has that been to repair the small bowel, or are these all side issues that are result?
Side issues. She's TPN dependent, so she's had numerous central lines placed and removed.
So the nutrition line that's attached to your backpack, Chelsea, it gets put in different places, in other words.
It has to go into a central vein into your heart, and they get infected. And when they get infected, you need to have them removed and then go through IV antibiotics and then get a new one placed. So she's been through numerous ones of those. She has different tubes in her stomach. She has one in her intestines, one in her stomach. She's had what's called a fundoplication, which is her stomach wrapped around her intestines and tied. Had muscle biopsies. She's had a lot of surgeries.
Okay. And so they know you at the hospital, right, Chelsea?
Yes, when
you
have many friends.
Yeah, I bet you have friends there. I would be your friend in a second. You know. Okay, so now how does, you must have some insurance coverage.
We do. You know, you still have the deductibles and co-pays. The problem with the transplant is Chelsea and I will have to relocate in the Pittsburgh area for 6 to 8 months post-transplant. So she'll be in the hospital for probably 2 months, you know, recovering from the transplant. And then we have to stay in the Pittsburgh area for 6 to 8 additional months.
I see. And then there's the cost of the operation.
The cost of the co-pays, the deductibles, travel expenses. She and I will, you know, have to charter a flight to get to Pittsburgh when we get the call for transplant, because she has to be there and ready for surgery within 5 to 6 hours of the phone call.
So you keep your phone, normally we would say to guests, phones off. But you are, of course, keeping your phone on because you can get a call about this at any time.
You can get a call at any point. She's been waiting for a year for transplant, and unfortunately you just never know when the call will come.
And how does this happen? I mean, this is hard to think about. This is hard to say. But, you know, as with most transplants that I know of, you know, I have a friend who had a liver transplant recently. Somebody had to die and then was very generous in saying, you know, before they died, or the family said, yes, we want these organs to continue to have life in somebody else's body and to help that next person. And so my friend got a liver transplant. And
that's amazing.
Yeah. And the family who lost somebody, they all met and they were very happy. And my friend said to them, we will take very good care of your daughter's liver. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing, Chelsea. So is it the same with a small bowel? Somebody has to die.
It is. They don't do living donors. So, yes, you're waiting for something unfortunate to happen to another family. It has to be compatible size, weight. So unfortunately, you're waiting for a child and for the family to, like you said, to decide to donate their child's organs. It's not a fun way to live, and or in a fortunate way to have to view things, but you have to wait for something unfortunate to happen.
Doug Clement.
It breaks down into kind of an age group also because of the size and weight. So the number of people on the list kind of get broken down into people,
yes,
Chelsea's age and size and weight in terms of where she stands in line.
So, Chelsea, that must mean for all of you that it keeps changing because, Chelsea, you're growing and you're getting older. And so one time you'd be in one category and the next time you're in another category. Is that how it goes?
Yes. Turning 11, she just went to the next age group. It was 6 to 10, and now it's, 11 to, the 15. So she did just go to the next age group.
And does it go by gender also, Doug?
I don't know that.
No, blood type, tissue type. There's so much that goes into finding a compatible organ. Intestines are not, very common transplants, very risky because intestines are just breeding bacteria, which, heightens your risk for rejection. So that's why there's not... there's 77,000 people waiting for kidneys and only 260 people waiting for an intestinal transplant. And I think there's, 32 at her particular hospital in her age group waiting for a transplant.
32 right now at the hospital?
At Pittsburgh Children's Hospital.
And that's where they specialize in this?
Yes.
Linda, do you know how the list moves in Chelsea's age group, how quickly people get the transplant?
No, they do not communicate that. They just tell you to keep your phone by you and keep waiting.
You have a fixed number in terms of her age group and, beyond that, do they give updates at a certain every year on where those numbers stand, every 6 months?
The numbers actually are updated daily at the UNOS website, but as far as the transplant center, so much goes into, in that 30, there's different blood types, there are different tissue types. There's at points where kids are unable to be transplanted if they have an infection or they're not well enough. So there's just so much to play into play, so they can't really give you a time frame.
One thing that was so impressive to me when I came to your house last autumn and we met was, families all over the state, they have enough challenges just getting their children to school and doing homework. And you have a big family, you and your husband, and you have managed to take all this experience and make it work. And you were telling me your husband, takes your other children to basketball and keeps them going, and you work with Chelsea mostly. And
yes,
your attitudes are so positive and so forward-looking, and it's just a really heartening thing to see such a challenge being dealt with so gracefully.
The great thing with Chelsea being one of five kids is you don't have time to overthink things and think, the worst of the situations. You just have to keep going and living, and we decided when we knew, how sick she was that my husband would, work and keep the other kids' lives as normal as possible. So they do baseball. My daughter does soccer. Just keep their life as normal as possible between Chelsea's hospitalizations and medical care.
And they keep my life fun.
Do they tell me how they do that?
Well, there's never a dull moment. I mostly play with my little sister, Julia. She's 7, and we do everything together, even some things Mom doesn't like us doing. And we share a room, and we're just best friends. And then my brothers are just fun to play with sometimes, and my sister is just fun, older sister.
Is your older sister the one you share the room with?
Well, I used to, but then my little sister was born, and I got to move in with her. And my older sister gets her own room, but we get the big room because we have two people.
So do you laugh a lot?
Yes.
I'm talking with 11-year-old Chelsea Wheeler and her mother, Linda Wheeler, of Oxford, Connecticut, and Doug Clement of Connecticut Magazine, who introduced me to the Wheelers and has been following them for a year. Chelsea Wheeler is in need of a rare transplant. It is a small bowel transplant. And an extraordinarily expensive and risky procedure. She's on a waiting list of about 265 people. We're also talking to Chelsea, not just about her illness, because that's just one part of her life, but it's about her dream. Look, she's fed through an intravenous line. She hasn't tasted real food in many, many years. I'll tell you, she has a dream and a plan. She wants to open a restaurant, and it's going to be called Shelley's. And she's even picked out the building. It's in Woodbury, Connecticut. And it's quite a thing. If you'd like to find out more about Chelsea Wheeler, her life, and helping her family in some way, go to our website right now at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Doug Clement is the person who first wrote about the Wheeler family and Chelsea Wheeler, her interest in food, and he told me about her. Doug is at Connecticut Magazine and is involved not only in the print issue, but also is a huge presence and director online for the magazine. And so I've been following his story, and we met for a drink, and we started talking about Chelsea, and that's how all of these folks have ended up in our studio, because like Doug, we wanted to meet and celebrate your dream, Chelsea, and also to help in some way if we can. Doug, what have you watched citizens do in not only in the town of Oxford, where the Wheelers live, but in other places? What's happened since you've written about the Wheeler family?
The response has really been amazing. I first learned of this story when, you know, like a lot of other journalists, I got an email press release about Chelsea and the group raising money for her. And I take the time to read everything in my inbox. And there was something special about this story. I just had a feeling from the beginning. I asked the person who emailed me if I could go and see the family in person, if that was okay or if that was too much of an imposition. And she said, fine. And we really just sort of bonded when I went. And, the food angle became the thing that has drawn a lot of attention to it. When I wrote that initial story last fall, CNN picked up on the story and came to visit the Wheeler family, you know, with great results. And chefs were reaching out to me on Twitter saying, because of the angle of Chelsea wanting to be a chef and own her own restaurant, we're saying, how can we help? I got a call from a public relations person in Massachusetts who works with restaurants and chefs saying, connect me, we want to help. That just built momentum because, as you know, in your show, Faith, the food community is so close-knit. People often have a misperception of restaurants and chefs in Connecticut or big cities, you know, being engaged in this intense competition and rivalries. And certainly that exists. But here in Connecticut, these chefs are friends. They do dinners in each other's restaurants. And when somebody, it's like having dinner. When you come together around food, you find all the best things in life and the best people. And you have the best people in the room right now. And the entire state and beyond has come together around them because food has been that unifying theme.
Well, to come full circle on this, as we heard from Chelsea, who is 11 and wants to have this restaurant and be a chef and is on the transplant list for a small bowel and waiting with great eagerness for what will be an extraordinary adventure if and when this happens. So to come full circle, there's also this building, you know, that Chelsea, you found in Woodbury, which is a great restaurant town, by the way, and it could use a few more. It could.
Yeah, the building in Woodbury that Chelsea has her eye on, I know it well. It's a huge barn-like structure that was built on spec as a commercial enterprise many, many years ago now. And I think and hope and pray it's a kind of karma because that building has never been occupied by a single tenant. It's vacant today. Some work is being done in the parking area. I'm guessing upgrading the septic system. It's approved for a restaurant, but it's just sitting there waiting for Chelsea's, I hope.
I really want the building.
Well, the second you open that restaurant, can I be your first customer?
After my mom.
That's a deal. That's only fair. Will you save me a table?
Yes.
Okay. My guests, Chelsea and Linda Wheeler of Oxford, Connecticut, and Doug Clement of Connecticut Magazine. We thank him especially. If you'd like to find out more about Chelsea Wheeler and fundraising efforts to help for this quite expensive procedure, please go online to our show, WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you, Faith.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Susan Casey talks about rogue waves out there in the ocean. Don't go away. I'm Faith Middleton. You can follow our show guest schedule and talk with us on Twitter at FaithWNPR. That's FaithWNPR. For centuries, mariners have spun tales of gargantuan waves 100 feet high or taller, appearing seemingly from nowhere in seas around the world. Until recently, scientists dismissed these stories as typical sailor talk because waves that high would violate the laws of physics. Well, author Susan Casey brings these city-destroying waves to life in her book, The Wave, which portrays human beings confronting nature at its most ferocious. As marine scientists scramble to understand the phenomenon of extreme rogue waves and tsunamis, another breed of people rejoice at the changes in the world's oceans. These are giant wave surfers who scan global weather updates on surfer websites and fly around the world looking for the ultimate challenge to become the first person to surf a 100-foot wave. How crazy is that? By the way, Wave is out in paperback. Susan Casey is editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Susan, I am so drawn to the water, to the ocean, yet I fear its power in many ways.
Well, waves are pretty fearsome, and I learned that myself when I was put in the hospital by a 4-foot wave. Well, I was in university, and from that point on, I was absolutely mesmerized by the notion that there were people out there surfing who wanted, whose idea of fun was to surf a 100-foot wave.
Well, how injured were you?
I ruptured a kidney. It was pretty bad.
Do you think it has something to do with the fact that you wanted to find out as much as you could about waves?
Well, I certainly was aware of the power in what was, you know, relatively small wave, and at the time, I was a very serious competitive swimmer. I swam for the University of Arizona, and I was pretty cocky about my abilities in the water. And all of a sudden, this thing comes along and just pinned me down and dragged me along the bottom. And as I said, it was a very small wave. And I then, at that point, I do think that it sort of twigged the notion in me that these are much more powerful than I had certainly realized.
Do surfers, I talked about fear for me as being part of my relationship with the water, but do you think surfers by nature have the ability to somehow switch off the fear button?
The surfers that I wrote about, the most notable of whom is Laird Hamilton, who's widely known as the greatest big wave surfer to have lived, would tell you they're far from fearless. They're just they manage their risk. Laird believes that if you're not scared when you're looking at a 100-foot wave, there's something wrong with you, and that fear is actually a very healthy response to seeing something that could annihilate you. And that, but this, at the same time, a lot of people, when they confront fear, will turn away from it. And what this group could do that I found very interesting is that they would look at these kinds of ferocious things, and they would use that fear as a kind of energy that would impel them into it, but in a way that, of course, they were very careful because they, you know, they wanted to make it back out.
When I was reading that, I was thinking to myself, there's something about that kind of logic that on the one hand makes sense, but on the other hand makes no sense to me. Because, of course, it would be reasonable to be afraid when you confront an enormous wave the way that they do. But most of us would then say, gee, I think I won't do that.
So it definitely, it was an interesting mindset that wants to put themselves into what I would consider to be one of nature's most extreme forces. One of my favorite statistics I came across was an 18-inch wave. It only takes an 18-inch wave to topple a wall built to withstand 125-mile-per-hour winds. And when I wrote that in the chapter and sent it into my editor, he queried me and said, surely you mean an 18-foot wave? And I wrote back and I said, no, it's an 18-inch wave. And water, you know, has 800 times more mass than air, and this water is moving at 40 miles an hour, and it's the size of a skyscraper. So, yeah, I mean, definitely a unique mindset.
What's the biggest wave you've ever seen personally?
During the reporting of the book, which really took me all over the world over the course of 5 years, I saw some waves upwards of 70 feet. And and it definitely was a very memorable experience to see. Any wave over 60 feet starts to act a little differently. They build much more slowly. They advance as a vertical wall, and there's a lot of feathering that goes on the top of it. So you have a few extra seconds to feel, you know, your eyes get really wide. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, anything over maybe 20 or 30 feet is a memorable experience.
I have a friend who's a quite experienced sailor, and he and two other buddies decided to take their, you know, pretty good-sized sailboat, but not huge, and sail it across to Europe. And so this is what they did, and he wrote an article later for Sailing Magazine. And he said there was a point when they got out there that no matter how much he had prepared and no matter how much he had already seen, when they were way out, the size of those waves when they started really rolling with a storm coming up was so terrifying that he thought, I'm going to die. I'm absolutely going to die.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was because I had come across the statistic and the quote from a European scientist that two large freighters a week go missing in the global seas, like just go missing without even a mayday, all hands lost. And I found this to be an astonishing statistic.
I know.
You know, and I began to look into it more. I had read this article in the New York Times about it. The notion was that rogue waves were just snapping these ships in half like pencils, and it didn't make any sense. And so I set out to find out if this was true. I couldn't believe it because we can find very small things. You know, we can take molecules apart. And how do you lose a 1,000-foot-long ship twice a week? And so I went to Lloyd's of London, which is the famed insurers that, of course, insure most of the global shipping fleet, to find out how true this was and what was really going on. And the number that I felt comfortable stating in the book was two large ships a month. That's still an astonishing number. And then when you think of your friend in his smaller boat, you really begin to realize how many boats do vanish. And as a matter of fact, I open the wave with a scene in which a research boat gets trapped in a vortex of 100-foot waves off the coast of Scotland that were completely unpredicted.
Yeah.
And as I sort of unfold the story in the book, it's, you know, scientists are realizing the ocean is a lot more volatile, a lot more nonlinear than some of the early mechanical physics equations indicated. So in other words, a rogue wave, which is a wave more than two times the size of the seas around it, can be even three or four times as big as the seas around it, is something that does occur. And yet it didn't make any sense to us for a very long time. It's only in the past 20 years that scientists have begun to understand this.
Yeah, this is what I want to talk with you about how they occur. We're talking with Susan Casey, who is also editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and has done this book called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. And it is in paperback now. San Francisco Chronicle named it one of the best books of the year, and it is quite an experience to read this, because she talks also about surfers who seek out these rogue waves and love to, and will travel great distances to do so, and love to go up against them. Sometimes they don't survive them, but these are people, I think, without some kind of risk button that the rest of us have. So, Susan, how does science at this point explain what these rogue waves are? How do they just appear? How is it that every once in a while there's a wave that is so astonishingly huge that it can take down these giant ships twice a month?
Well, there are a number of different ways they can occur, and some of them are understood and some aren't. There are three or four different conditions under which you can get rogue waves or freak waves. Scientists kind of use those terms interchangeably. And one of the more common ways is if you get a very fast, warm current, like, say, the Gulf Stream, or the one that I wrote about more extensively, which is the Agulhas Current off the coast of Southeast Africa.
Mm.
And then you get fast storm weather moving in the opposite direction. In off of Africa, of course, you get these big storms from Antarctica that come across long distances. The wind builds them up. They're very strong. And then they hit this this current that's moving maybe, you know, 8-10 knots sometimes, and it's warm, and it's just like this violent collision. And in that violent collision, the waves become very steep, and when they're very steep, they're very far away from equilibrium, and they can, you know, I explain what I have come to see as very complicated scientific theories about quantum physics and quantum mechanics and things in very simple ways in the book because I want everybody to be able to understand them. And I just, you know, to me, I called it an oceanic train wreck. If you can imagine just this collision, and one wave suddenly sort of ends up about 3 times higher than the waves around it. And one scientist explained it to me as it manages somehow to pirate the energy from other waves around it. It's really unstable. It will be perhaps breaking in places where waves wouldn't be expected to break in the open ocean. It's really just a steep avalanche of water. So they understand that. And then there are certain anomalous situations that they don't understand as well. And, you know, it continues to be a mystery, like so many things in the ocean.
How do tsunamis figure into all this?
Well, tsunamis are a different kind of wave entirely. And in the book, I wanted to touch on every kind of giant wave, and they're certainly the biggest of the big. They have super long wavelengths, which is why they can travel so fast, and they travel at the speed of jets. And they're caused by lurchings, basically, in the Earth's crust, by huge disruptions with a geological basis. A certain kind of earthquake that displaces water vertically will create a tsunami, as will an underwater landslide. That's some of the biggest tsunamis in history have been created that way. And then, of course, you get a really obvious phenomena, which I wrote about up in Alaska, where large bits of debris, say glacier material or rock, you know, come into the ocean and create basically a giant splash, and that's a kind of localized tsunami. So they're very violent, very big waves, quite rare, but they do happen. And of course, we've seen in the past 10 years 2 major tsunamis, and they are, I believe, the most destructive of all the natural forces. When you think of Indonesia, especially, you can see it was just annihilated that part of the world.
I know. When you were talking with scientists, did they mention climate change as being connected in any way, not necessarily to the creation of storms, but to the intensity of things happening?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that a lot. It's a very complicated process to understand, and because we've only had satellites since 1980, so a lot of these very large climate cycles are far beyond anything that we have the ability to understand at this point. But what's really clear is there's more heat being added to the system, so things are more volatile, and at the same time, glaciers are melting and sea levels are rising. Those are very quantifiable things. So if you add more heat to the system, the most intense storms have more fuel. And that is what they feel comfortable saying that they can prove at this point, is that if you have extreme storms, you will have more extreme extremes, which will obviously lend itself to more volatile oceans. But the real problem with climate change, a lot of them sort of regretfully said to me, was by the time we prove every last aspect of it, it will be too late. It's a very large and long process to understand the world's climate systems, and probably in our lifetimes we won't.
When I see the huge chunk of a glacier just crack off and fall into the water, you see the drama of that happening, and I've often thought, what kind of, does that create a wave locally that, you know, and how far does that go?
Well, it doesn't go very far, but it's very violent. And in one of the chapters, I write about the largest wave that's ever been measured, which was 1,140 feet tall in a place called Latoya Bay, Alaska, that was basically caused by an earthquake shaking off large chunks of a very steep mountain range in a very deep bay, and causing a giant, giant, violent splash to come up and scalp the trees of the surrounding mountains so that it was possible for scientists to understand exactly how high this wave was. And what's extremely rare about this wave was that there were, at the time, three fishing boats in this little bay. It was in July 1958, and 2 of the 3 boats survived. And if you can imagine what kind of a bad night that would be to hear, to be in the middle of a giant earthquake, hear a big rumbling and see about a 300-foot wave coming at you, because after there is the initial giant splash, then it kind of rolls a little bit, and it, at the same time, it's still really frightfully high. And they were able to go in afterwards and see just how much damage this wave had done. But it's very local. It didn't go for hundreds of miles or anything like that. It had dissipated by the time it got out to the Bay of Alaska.
We're talking with Susan Casey, who is also editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and has done this book called The Wave, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. And it is in paperback now. San Francisco Chronicle named it one of the best books of the year, and it is quite an experience to read this, because she talks also about surfers who seek out these rogue waves and love to, and will travel great distances to do so, and love to go up against them. Sometimes they don't survive them, but these are people, I think, without some kind of risk button that the rest of us have. Earlier in our conversation, when you were talking about this legend of surfing, Laird Hamilton, he and his friends figured out how to ride these impossibly large waves. We're talking about 70, 80 feet. How do they do it?
Well, they work in a team, and because the waves, when they get over, say, 40 feet high, they're moving so fast that a person can't paddle into them the way that surfers would typically paddle onto a wave. So they need to be going at the same speed as the wave in order to catch it. So what they did was they invented a lot of very specialized equipment, smaller surfboards that were heavier so they had less friction on the surface, the foot straps so they could handle really extreme G-forces when they got to the bottom of a 70-foot wave and had to turn. Mm-hmm. And then they towed one another on using jet skis and water ski ropes. So they were working in pairs all of a sudden, which was unique, and, you know, with this technique that they had invented specifically so they could go out and ride this one particular wave off the coast of Maui called Jaws.
I just find it impossible to understand how they could look at something. I mean, there's a picture here on the cover of your book that is just frightening. And I think, imagine going on a small board into that, and one mistake, how you would ever come out of it.
One of the things, it's very hard to even convey it in film or video. And if listeners want to see it's called toe surfing in action, they can go to the Waves page on Facebook. We have some videos up there, and or Google Laird Hamilton and go to YouTube, and you'll see it. And it actually is astonishing when you get a sense of really how fast the wave is moving at the same time as it, of course, being huge.
It's so tall. And we all know, if you've been in the water and you've, like you, Susan, have felt that pull and gotten caught in the wrong place, how it can just smash you down. It's life-threatening every single time they do this. That's what I can't understand.
The first time I went out on the West Coast with some surfers at a wave called Mavericks off the coast of San Francisco, it was a very violent day. The waves were 60 and 70 feet. The visibility was quite bad. And a boat nearby with two fishermen in it capsized, and the fishermen perished. And then about 30 miles down the coast at another giant wave called Ghost Tree, which breaks off the 18th hole of Pebble Beach, a surfer was killed that day. So, you know, on a day where, you know, I don't know, there were maybe 30 people in the water and 3 people died. So it's an incredibly difficult, treacherous thing.
We've got 30 seconds. Just quickly, well, the thing that scares me as much as waves are riptides. Did you have a chance to look into what causes that?
No, but I've been caught in one before in open water swimming, and
really?
I agree with you, they're scary.
Oh, my God. And does it just carry you away, right?
Right. It's a current. You know, it's a current that probably comes as a result of other prevailing currents and features on the bottom. It's certainly a very powerful element.
I've been on Nantucket, where the hotels will post signs at the front desk that will say, this beach has riptides, don't swim there, you know, and of course people do. And so I've gotten pretty familiar with that. Thank you so much. What a fascinating book.
Thank you so much.
Susan Casey, author of The Wave, now out in paperback, In Pursuit of the Rogues, Freaks, and Giants of the Ocean. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Our talented producers are Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.